This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents No Earls Allowed by Shayna Galen. Narrated by Victoria Aston. 1. London, 1816. Neil woke and gulped in air. The acrid smell of cannon smoke burned his lungs, and the stench of burning flesh assaulted his nostrils. His hands fisted in the sheets on the bed, their softness reminding him he was not lying on a battlefield beside his dead brother, but in his bed in his flat in London. Without looking, he reached for the glass of gin on the bedside table. There was always a glass of gin on the bedside table. It wasn't a gentleman's drink, but here, in the dark, alone with his demons, Neil didn't want to be a gentleman. And so he bought gin for the nights when the dreams of battle haunted him, and when he drank the bitter brew, he tried to forget he was the son of a marquis. He sipped the gin and lit a lamp, taking solace in the fact that his hands didn't shake. If he'd dreamed on, he likely would have woken with trembling hands and a scream echoing in his ears. For as he'd lain beside his dead brother on that hill in Portugal, the smoke of the battlefield had coalesced around him, settling inside him. Instead of stifling him, the smoke caught the breeze and the flame of rage ignited within him. The fire built until it seared and burned, and he'd not been able to quench the heat until he rose and, with a roar, stumbled after the French soldiers the dragoons hadn't routed. Like a berserker, he'd cut every one of them down, even as they raised hands in surrender, even as they'd begged for quarter. Neil had expected to be reprimanded for his behavior that day, behavior unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, but Draven had pulled him aside and given him a promotion of sorts. If one could call leading a suicide troop a promotion. The flame of rage had long been extinguished, and in its place lay a weight like a sodden mantle, bowing his shoulders. Neil could not shed it, no matter how hard he tried. Now he rose and pulled on trousers and a linen shirt. He didn't bother to tuck in the shirt or button it at the throat or sleeves. Instead, he padded to the window and pushed the heavy curtains open. He had a view of St. James's Street. He liked the sight of carriages and men coming and going from gambling hells or brothels. He liked the noise and the lights spilling from the establishments. It drowned out the sounds of battle that too easily plagued him in silence. Neil stood and stared out the window for a long time before shoving his feet into boots and shrugging on a coat. His manservant would not arrive until later in the morning, so Neil managed the cravat on his own. As for his wild hair, he combed his fingers through it, pushing the sides out of his eyes. He had no one to inform of his departure. He lived alone, a necessity when one woke screaming 5 out of 7 nights of the week. He took his walking stick as a precaution against drunkards who might be stupid enough to accost him, and left for his club. 20 minutes later, Porter greeted him. "Mr. Wraxall," the older, distinguished gentleman said as he opened the door. "A pleasure to see you, sir." Neil handed the master of the house his walking stick. "Don't you ever sleep, Porter?" Porter raised his brows, silver to match his hair. "Don't you, sir?" "Not unless I have to. I know it's 3:30. Is anyone here?"
"Mr. Beaumont is asleep in the card room."
No doubt Rafe had retreated to the Draven Club to escape some woman. Neil might have laughed if he hadn't come to escape his own demons, not that the club didn't have its ghosts. His gaze strayed to the shield hanging directly opposite the door where no one entering could miss it. It was a silver shield, bisected by a thick medieval sword with a pommel shaped like a fleur-de-lis. Under the grip, the crossguard was ornamented with a skull. It would not have been particularly macabre, except for the 18 marks on the flanks and base. Each fleur-de-lis, 9 on the dexter side and 9 on the sinister side, stood for a member of the troop of Draven's men Neil had lost during the war. Neil often felt he carried the weight of the enormous shield on his back.
"Anyone else here?" he asked the master of the house.
"No, sir."
Porter placed the walking stick in a stand, his wooden leg thumping on the carpet.
"Would you care for a drink or something to eat, sir?"
Neil wanted more gin, if only to settle his nerves, but he could have drunk himself into a stupor at his flat. He'd come here to affect civility. He'd come here because it was the closest thing to home he'd ever known.
"Brandy would suit me, Porter."
Though Neil could have found it blindfolded, Porter led him up the winding staircase and into the dining room. The 5 round tables in the panelled wood room were empty, their white linen tablecloths bright and clean and anticipating the next diner. Neil chose a chair near the big hearth and settled back. The silence here didn't bother him. He could all but hear the echoes of his friends' voices, those who had survived, raised in song or laughter. He half expected to look to the side and see Ewan Mostyn, the brawny, muscled protector of the group, bent over a meal, or spot Ralph Beaumont leaning negligently against one of the walls, under a sconce. Neil never felt alone here. Porter returned with the brandy on a silver salver. Neil had told the man 100 times such gestures were unnecessary, but Porter believed in standards. Neil lifted the brandy, then frowned at the folded white paper that had been beneath it.
"I almost forgot, sir. This note came for you a few hours ago."
Neil lifted it and nodded to the silver-haired master of the house, who departed quite gracefully, considering he had but one leg. It didn't surprise Neil that the correspondence meant for him had been sent here. He was here more than anywhere else, and anyone who knew him knew that. He broke the seal and opened the paper, recognizing the hand immediately. It was from the Marquis of Kensington. It said simply, "Call on me at the townhouse at your earliest convenience. I have need of you. Kensington." Neil folded the letter and put it in his pocket. It was not unusual for his father to request Neil's assistance with various tasks, from inspecting an investment opportunity to travelling to one of the Marquis's many estates and assisting the steward with a duty or question. As a bastard, Neil had no social commitments and no obligations to the Kensington title, as his elder brothers did. In Neil's opinion, acting in his father's stead was the least he could do, considering his father had claimed him, seen that he had been educated, and now granted him an allowance of sorts. The Marquis would never have called it payment for Neil's services, but that was what it amounted to. Neil bore his legitimate brothers no ill will, and they had always been civil to him, especially Christopher. Neil and Christopher had been friends as well as brothers. The Marquis's wife had always been coolly polite to him, though it must have chafed every time she encountered him. No doubt she wished Neil, not Christopher, had died in Portugal. Neil was the product of Kensington's liaison with a beautiful Italian woman he'd been introduced to in London shortly after the birth of his second son. He'd been instantly smitten, and what ensued was a brief and passionate affair. The Marchioness had looked the other way, suffering in silence as other women of her class had before her. The relationship might have gone on indefinitely if Neil's mother had not conceived a child and, after a difficult pregnancy, died of complications. Neil had never known his mother. Instead, he'd been raised by a farmer and his wife who lived on Kensington's Lancashire estate. He'd been a small, dark child with startlingly blue eyes and a fondness for wood carving, like his foster father, and horses, like his real father. Neil had always known the Marquis was his real father. The giant of a man had come to visit him without fail once a month, unless he was in town for the season. At 8, Neil had gone to school. Not Eton, like his brothers, but a good school for middle-class children, and he'd learned reading and writing and arithmetic. He'd left school, and his father had bought him a commission in the cavalry. On his own merits, he'd earned a position in the 16th Light Dragoons, also known as the Queen's Lancers. He'd always been proud of his service as a member of the 16th. He was not so proud of the service he'd done afterward, but his father did not want to speak to him about the war or how Neil had sold his soul to Lieutenant Colonel Draven on the same day Christopher had been killed. The Marquis didn't blame Neil for Christopher's death. Neil still blamed himself for that death and those that followed, and he would spend the rest of his days in atonement. He looked down at the note once again. Cold seeped along his limbs as he reread it. Neil had a feeling he wouldn't like what his father requested this time, and not simply because he'd be expected to be sober when hearing it. With a sigh, Neil rose, threw the brandy in the fire, and prepared for the worst. 2. Lady Juliana, only remaining daughter of the Earl of St. Maur, could have screamed. She'd had a more abominable morning than usual, and that was saying something. First, she'd been called away from the Duke of Devonshire's ball by the appearance of Robbie, one of the orphans, from the Sunnybrook Home for Boys. He told her she must come immediately. There was an emergency at the orphanage, and she'd made her excuses and run out, much to her father's annoyance. It probably hadn't helped matters that she'd taken the family coach. Then she'd arrived at the orphanage, just as the sun was rising, to find that her cook was packing her bags to leave. Julia had known it would happen sooner or later. She'd simply hoped it would be later. Mrs. Nesbit had been complaining for months about the state of the kitchen, claiming she could hardly be expected to work in such conditions. Julia had agreed. The oven smoked, the roof leaked, and the boys had stolen all the decent knives. Lately, Mrs. Nesbit had also complained the staples she stocked had been steadily disappearing as well. Flour, cornmeal, potatoes, and garlic. Julia wondered if perhaps Mrs. Nesbit was cheating her and selling the stock on the sides, but she had no proof and couldn't afford to lose the cook. She'd begged Mrs. Nesbit to give her more time to ask the orphanage's board for money and make the repairs. She'd thought she'd succeeded at persuading the woman, until, of course, the boys had thought it amusing to loose 3 tame rats in the kitchen as Mrs. Nesbit prepared breakfast. When Charlie had shown her the rats again, just to prove they were harmless, the poor cook had shrieked loud enough to wake the dead, or at least the dead tired, as Juliana thought of herself, and resigned, effective immediately. Which meant Julia had to cook the boys' breakfast. One could not simply allow a dozen boys to go hungry, and she did not have the funds to buy them all pies from the hawkers' carts, not when each boy ate as much as a horse. And so, Julia had calmly collected the rats, placed them back in their straw-lined box with a bit of bread for their breakfast, and, in her jewels and dancing slippers, heated oats in a large pot she could barely move. She tried not to feel sorry for herself. Even as she rolled and kneaded bread until her arms ached, she pushed memories of walks in the promenade and ices at Gunter's tea shop aside. And when her once lovely, copper-coloured ball gown was covered in flour and sticky pieces of dough, Juliana did not allow her thoughts to stray to all the lovely balls where she had worn the gown and danced with countless handsome and charming gentlemen. Or at least, she didn't allow her thoughts to stray much. But no sooner had she placed the bread in the oven when Mr. Goring, her manservant, had knocked on the open door and informed her Mr. Slag was waiting for her in the parlour. Julia had stared at the servant as though the man had gone mad. Sticky, white hands on her hips, she'd glowered at Mr. Goring until he'd lowered his eyes. "Why on earth did you seat Mr. Slag in the parlour?" She also wanted to ask where he had been when the boys he was supposed to be watching in her absence were foisting rats on the cook, but she couldn't afford to lose Mr. Goring too. "There ain't nowhere else except the dining room, and the lads is in there making a racket about wanting their victuals." Julia had heard and ignored the noise. If the boys had wanted to be fed in good time, they shouldn't have taunted the cook with the rats. What I meant, Mr. Goring, she clarified, though she knew he'd understood her perfectly, is why did you admit Mr. Slag? I told you never to admit him, not under any circumstances. Goring scratched the sparse hair at the crown of his forehead.
Did you want me to close the door on him?
No. She spoke slowly and deliberately, as she often spoke to Charlie, who was 4.
I wanted you to say what I told you to say. But, my lady, you are home.
Not to him.
Defeated, she removed the apron that was supposed to protect her ball gown and tossed it on the work table. She'd deal with Mr. Slag, then serve breakfast. Before leaving the kitchen, she closed the box with Matthew, Mark, and Luke and perched it under one arm. She did not want to risk the rodents escaping into the kitchen and causing more mayhem. With a last look of annoyance at Goring, she marched toward the parlour, passing the dining room as she did so. She studiously avoided turning her head to look in. The boys were stomping their feet on the floor and banging their plates on the table. They needed a lecture, and she had no time at present to give it. She wanted to be angry at Mr. Goring for admitting Slag, but she supposed Goring was as frightened as Mr. Slag as everyone else in Spitalfields. The crime lord ran the rookery, and his methods for dealing with those who displeased him were rather harsh. Julia was frightened of him as well, but she was able to mask her fear better than most. After all, she'd met other imposing figures, the king, the queen, Wellington and Brummel, to name a few. If she hadn't flinched when Brummel had scrutinized her dress with his quizzing glass, she would not flinch when confronted by Mr. Slag. And truth be told, until recently, he'd been no more than a minor irritation. But as she'd been forced to spend more time at the orphanage and less at her father's home in Mayfair, Mr. Slag had been harder to push to the back of her mind. She opened the door to the parlour, and Slag rose immediately. He was a robust man, and not very tall, only a few inches taller than she. He had mentioned on several occasions that he had been reared in a foundling house. She knew how cruel and heartless such institutions could be, which was one reason she was here and trying to improve the lives of the orphans under her care, but Joseph Slag had obviously found no such protector. He might have been a handsome man if not for the ravages of his brutal youth, his crooked nose, the deep lines around his eyes and mouth, and his cold, hard eyes were testament to the harsh life he'd led. Even dressed in fine linen and well-tailored clothing, he wore his low station like a permanent mantle. Joseph Slag was known to always carry an ebony walking stick with a golden handle in the image of a flame. The rumour was that he'd beaten more than one man to death with the stick. Julia glanced at the stick now, leaning against the armchair Slag had occupied, and tried not to shudder. She pasted on a bright smile.
"Mr. Slag, how lovely to see you this morning."
She set the box of rats on the table just inside the room and curtsied prettily. Her mother would have been proud. Slag bowed with some style of his own.
"Lady Juliana, how kind of you to take time from your busy morning to see me."
He hadn't given her much choice, but she merely smiled and took the seat across from the one he'd occupied.
"I'm afraid I am not at leisure to chat this morning, sir. My cook has given her notice, and as you no doubt can hear, I have hungry boys to feed."
"Ah, no wonder you look..."
His eyes travelled down her dress, lingering a bit too long on her breasts, all but on display in the ball gown.
"Out of sorts. May I be of some assistance?"
"Do you cook?" she asked. He gave her a look of appalled shock.
"Then I'm afraid not."
"What I meant, my lady, is that maybe I could find you a new cook. I'm well connected, I am. Maybe I'll hire a maid for you too."
He didn't look at the dust covering the table near him, but Julia knew he'd seen it, nevertheless.
I thank you kindly, Mr. Slag, but I have a maid, though she only came once a week, and I already have another cook in mind. That was a blatant lie, but she knew that without a doubt it would be a mistake to put herself in Mr. Slag's debt. She'd made that mistake once before, and she would not repeat it.
Then maybe I could make a donation to the orphanage. I know what hardships these boys face.
Julia raised her hand. That is far too generous of you, Mr. Slag. I couldn't possibly accept any more of your charity. He moved closer.
Then maybe you've given some consideration to my other proposal.
The other proposal? The proposal of... It hadn't exactly been marriage. Lord, she'd hoped he had forgotten about that. When he'd propositioned her last week, she pretended she hadn't understood what he meant. Perhaps that tactic would work again.
I cannot recall another proposal at the moment, Mr. Slag, but I am ever so distressed this morning.
She rose.
If you could call another time.
His hand came down hard on her shoulder, and she flinched from the feel of his leather gloves on her bare skin.
Allow me to remind you, Lady Juliana, I offered you my protection.
Thank you very much. She slid out of his grip. Now, if you will excuse...
Stop playing games. I am a man of business, and you are not a stupid woman. There are dangerous men about, and you and the children who live here need a protector.
Julia didn't need to translate his words. He was the dangerous man.
I am offering you my protection for a small fee.
Small fee?
I do believe you mentioned £1,000, Mr. Slag.
That is no small fee.
Your father is an earl.
Yes, and most of his money is tied up in lands.
There is another option.
He moved closer, his round belly brushing against her dress.
You can pay the fee by offering me a place in your bed. You're an attractive woman.
His gaze slid to her breasts, making her skin itch.
And even the gentry like a bit of slap and tickle. What do you say, Julia?
Though abhorrent to her, he made the proposal in earnest. He probably thought it more than fair, and if she had been another woman, she might have agreed without blinking an eye. Her father had tried to marry her off to men ranging from elderly to lecherous. What did Slag propose but a similar arrangement without the permanence of the vows? But Julia had not come to Spitalfields to end up some man's plaything. She could have stayed home in Mayfair and become a kept woman. Which meant her answer to Slag was an unqualified never. No, not ever. But one did not say such things to Mr. Slag and walk away with one's brains intact. Julia liked her head round, not smashed flat on the carpet. And so she smiled and chose one of the many phrases she knew and had used in the past on the sons of dukes and viscounts and lowly barons.
"Sir, you flatter me with your proposal. This is all so sudden."
"Then maybe you just need a bit of persuading."
He reached for her, and she took a step back.
Dear God, she dearly hoped this would not turn into him chasing her about the parlour.
And why hadn't she seen this coming? The problem was that she spent only part of the week within the walls of the St. Dismas Home for Wayward Youth, rather, Sunnybrook Home for Boys, as she had renamed it. And during that time, she was so absorbed with the problems of the boys and running the orphanage, she had no time to consider how to deal with Mr. Slag. And when she might have snatched a moment to deal with the problem, she had to return to Mayfair to be thrust into the world of the Ton, and then Slag and Sunnybrook seemed so far away. But Slag was not far away now. He was far too near, and her strategy of ignoring him and hoping he'd go away would not work this time. She took another step back, and he followed, but she was saved from running behind her desk when someone tapped on the parlour door.
"Come in!"
she yelled.
"Please!"
The door opened to reveal Mr. Goring.
"Sorry to interrupt, my lady. Not at all, Mr. Goring. Come in!"
She crossed to him and pulled him inside.
"You should join us!"
He frowned at her as though the ways of the upper classes were foreign and mysterious to him.
"You have another caller, my lady."
Julia frowned. Another caller? Who on earth would be calling on her here? Her friends had been forbidden to visit her here, and her father did not rise from his bed this early, and when she did see him, he preferred she go to him at their townhouse in Mayfair. It occurred to her that this caller might be one of Slag's men, in which case she would be in worse straits than at present.
"Do you know the caller?" "No, my lady. He says it's a matter of, what was the word? Urgency."
"He?" Then the thought struck her. It was a representative from the bank. Perhaps the board had made good on its threat not to pay the mortgage, and the bank had come to close her down.
"Tell him to come back later," Slag ordered.
"No!"
Bank representative or no, whoever it was would be an improvement on Slag.
"Show him in, Mr. Goring."
Goring looked from her to Slag.
"Go on, Mr. Goring," she said as forcefully as she could. "Show him in."
"Maybe I should come back at a more opportune time," Slag said.
"Please do, Mr. Slag. I'm so sorry we were interrupted.
May I call on you tonight?"
"Tonight? No, I'm very, very busy tonight."
He lifted his stick, then crossed to her and took her hand. At some point during their little dance, he'd removed his gloves, and as she'd removed hers in the kitchen, the press of his bare fingers on hers made her throat tighten.
"You can't put me off forever, Lady Juliana," he said softly. "Lest you forget, I'm a man who gets what I want, and the longer you make me wait, the more I want."
With that, he strolled out of the room, jostling the man entering. The two stopped, looked each other up and down, and then with a warning glare, Slag went on his way. The other man watched him, then strode into the room.
"Friend of yours?" he asked.
Julia let out a breath, then caught it again. She blinked at the man before her, but she had not dreamed him. He was better than any dream her mind might have conjured. It was as though he had just stepped out of a painting depicting a god or an angel. He was tall, but not so tall she had to crane her neck to look up at him, and he had olive skin with a touch of gold. His thickly lashed eyes were the most beautiful shade of blue she had ever seen. She had never been to the Mediterranean Sea, but this was what she imagined the waters would look like. His hair brushed his collar, the thick waves falling about his face. With a cupped hand, he brushed them back in what must have been a habitual gesture, then, seeming to remember his manners, bowed to her. His bow and the attention it drew to his clothing told her everything she needed to know. This man was no crime lord. He was of her father's ilk. Her ilk, when she was playing the part of Lady Juliana in Mayfair drawing rooms. His dark coat fit snugly over broad shoulders, his cravat was snowy white against bronze skin, and his breeches strained quite nicely over muscled thighs. She tried to speak over the pounding of her heart.
"You will forgive me, sir, if I do not recall having met you before."
She hadn't met him. If she'd met him, she would not have forgotten.
"My lady," he said in a deep voice, "it is you who must forgive me."
He had a cultured British accent, with no hint of the Spanish or Italian that must run in his blood.
"I'm sorry to call on you without notice. I do, however, have letters of introduction from your father and mine."
He reached in the pocket of his waistcoat and withdrew a small packet of papers. He handed them over smoothly, his gloved hand brushing hers. Her heart thudded again, and she looked up at his face. He was perfect, so handsome that he did not seem real. If he'd asked her to dance a waltz, she'd have said yes and suffered her father's displeasure, what she wouldn't give to press against his strong, muscled body. The man cleared his throat and raised his brows. Julia realized she had been staring too long and hadn't offered him a seat.
"Where are my manners?"
she said, keeping her eyes down. He must think her a complete ninny, and she was. If she looked at him again, she'd probably start drooling.
"Please sit. I should offer you tea, but my cook just..."
Quite suddenly she remembered the bread and the oatmeal.
"Oh, dear God!"
Dropping the letters, she hurried toward the door. Why hadn't she smelt the smoke earlier? Her bread was burning. Unfortunately, her guest blocked the door, and she swerved to the side to avoid colliding with his shoulder. That sudden motion brought her hip in contact with the table near the door, which held the box of rats. She'd placed it precariously close to the edge. That was her fault. And at the collision, it tumbled toward the floor. Uttering a shriek, she bent and caught the box, but one of the rats, Mark, she thought, managed to catch his little paws on the edge and began to climb out. Julia shoved the box under her arm, caught the little creature before he could escape, tucked him in the small silk pocket tied under her gown, and raced for the kitchen. Behind her, the visitor muttered, "What the hell?" Julia didn't have time for explanations. She spotted Robbie's concerned face peering out of the dining room. At 11, he was one of the older orphans and had stick-straight brown hair framing a long, amply freckled face. The children's din had quieted now, as they had probably smelled the smoke as well and realized their breakfast was in jeopardy.
"My lady, I smelled..."
Robbie began. She raised a hand.
"I am on my way, Robbie."
She burst through the door to the kitchen. Smoke filled the area near the oven, its acrid smell making her nostrils burn. She placed the box of rodents on a chair near the work table and grabbed the first towel her hand landed on, a thin one for dish drying. Wrapping her hand, she used the towel to open the oven door. More black smoke poured out. Waving the towel to disperse the smoke and coughing so hard her lungs burned, Julia reached in and took hold of the bread. As soon as she had it free of the oven, she realized the towel was scant protection from the heat of the charred bread.
"Ow!"
She tossed the bread in the air, catching it again so it would not land on the floor, just in case it was salvageable. She quickly dumped it on the work table and frowned at the charred loaf.
"May I be of some assistance?" her too handsome guest asked, stepping gingerly into the kitchen.
Julia refrained from moaning. She had no time to mourn the loss of the bread. She might still save the oats. A quick glance at the hearth showed the oats bubbling over the big black pot. Mindful of her raw hand, she took a moment to locate the thick, quilted mitten, slip it on her hand, and pull the pot away from the fire. She lifted the large spoon hanging nearby and stirred the oatmeal. The top layer of mush ceased bubbling onto the floor, but the oats at the bottom stuck fast to the pot. Breakfast had been burned. Tears stung her eyes.
"Is there anything I can do to help?" the visitor asked from the door. She heaved out a sigh.
"Not unless you can repair burnt oatmeal or bake bread."
"I confess I have no talent in either arena. Was that the children's breakfast?"
Abruptly, the man took a step back.
I don't mean to alarm you, but you have a mouse in your pocket."
She looked down to where Mark's head poked out.
"It's a rat," she said. "Think, Juliana, there must be something else you can prepare." If only she had restocked the larder, but the shelves were all but bare.
My mistake.
Mark had wriggled to the edge of her pocket, and she caught him before he could make a bid for freedom. There had to be more oats, and she knew there were potatoes. Potatoes took so long to cook, though.
Here.
She held the rat out to her visitor absently. He took a large step back, his gaze telling her exactly how daft he thought her.
"Will you hold him for a moment?" she asked in exasperation. "I need to search for something to cook."
"No, I will not."
"Oh, don't be missish. He's harmless."
"Missish?" His blue eyes narrowed.
She shoved Mark into the visitor's hands. The visitor made a sound somewhere between a grunt and a curse, but he held the animal securely while she searched cabinets and shelves.
"If that was breakfast," the visitor said, "perhaps you could have the cook start on the noon meal. It's nigh 11.
"I don't have a cook," she said, the feeling of hopelessness growing as she found nothing but empty drawers and bins. "She quit this morning."
Silence.
"Then perhaps your lady's maid—"
"She quit last week."
"Your manservant, then? Allow me to send the man to fetch bread or pies from one of the street vendors."
She rose, wishing she could disappear just for an hour back to her Mayfair life with its scones and drinking chocolate.
I would, she said with a sigh, but I don't have the coin to spare.
Then allow me. She whirled to face him.
I cannot do that, sir.
I would gladly pay the price if it meant I could relinquish my role as rat-holder. She almost laughed.
I do apologize.
She took Mark from him and placed him in the box that served as the rat's cage.
My manners are sorely lacking this morning.
You have nothing to apologize for. His gaze met hers, and she found it hard to breathe with those Mediterranean sea eyes so focused on her. Had she ever known a man this handsome? She didn't think so, and she had known many handsome men. She'd had her share of seasons and beaux over the years. She realized she'd once again stared at him too long when he lifted a brow.
"How many more of those are you wearing?"
he asked with a nod at the box of rats.
"Just the one. There are three in total."
She lifted the box so he could see, but he didn't even lean forward to catch a glimpse.
"Their names are Matthew, Mark, and Luke," she said, knowing she was babbling now and wishing she would simply shut up.
"What happened to John?"
"We don't discuss John."
His eyes almost smiled at her then, though his mouth remained tight.
"I understand. Give me a quarter hour, and I'll return with warm food."
"Really, Mr. Sir, I cannot allow you to do that."
"Lady Juliana," he said, already starting for the door, "you cannot stop me."
He paused and looked back at her.
"And you look like you need all the help you can muster."
With that, he was gone. She sank into the chair and would have cried, except that she did need help, and just the knowledge this man would take care of breakfast was one small weight off her shoulders. But that weight was quickly replaced by a glance at the state of the kitchen. It was in shambles, and without the cook here, she would be the one to clean it.
"My lady," Robbie stood in the doorway. "Yes, Robbie. Who was that man?"
"I..." Good question. She'd never had a chance to look at the letters of introduction.
"I don't know yet, but he's gone to fetch you and the other boys something to eat."
A roar sounded from the hallway, and she realized the other boys must have been standing behind Robbie.
"Before he comes back, will you please take your pets up to your room? They've caused enough trouble for one day."
Robbie looked chastened, almost.
"Sorry, my lady."
"I'm sure you are." The boys were always sorry after they'd done something wrong. For the life of her, she could not seem to teach them to think of the consequences before they acted. Robbie took the box and, with a quick smile she could not quite resist, ran off. The other boys followed, all but James, who was about 5 and as blonde as a Dutchman.
"Is the man coming back?"
James asked in his sweet high voice.
"I should think so," she answered, tussling his pale hair affectionately. "And he'll bring your breakfast with him. Are you hungry?"
"Yes, my lady,"
he nodded vigorously.
"Will you fix yourself before he returns, my lady?"
Julia raised her brows.
"Fix myself?"
"Aye, my lady. You look a fright, and we'll never find a father if you scare all the good ones away."
Julia opened her mouth to reply, but she was saved from saying who knew what when James scampered away. She stared after him, her eyes burning for another reason. In the few weeks she'd been here, some of the younger boys had become quite affectionate with her, even mistakenly calling her Mama. Most of the time, it was when they were sleepy or needed comfort from a scrape or tumble. She had thought it an innocent mistake, but was it? Had the boys begun to think of her as their mother, and were they, as James suggested, looking for her to find them a father? She would happily mother them all as much as she could, but she had seen all of marriage and fathers she could ever want, and yet clearly a house full of boys needed a man to look up to. She didn't even have a cook at present. Where would she find a man to guide a dozen orphans? How did one even advertise for a position like that? Remembering James had said she looked a fright, she lifted one of the trays on the work table. It was scratched and tarnished, but she could see well enough. Flowers streaked her face and her coiffure was askew. She did look a fright. Normally she wouldn't have cared a whit, but normally she didn't meet handsome strangers. Not that he had come to court her or any such foolishness. No, if her father had sent him, she had to consider him an enemy. Still, she supposed it would not hurt to put her appearance to rights, and she would have done so if she hadn't heard the yell and the crash and had to run up 3 flights of stairs yelling, "What have you done now?" 3. Neil found a man with a cart selling some sort of freshly baked pies. The food smelled decent enough to him, but as he had no intention of hauling 2 dozen pies back to the St. Dismas Home for Wayward Youth, he paid the man to bring the cart to the building. When they arrived at the servants' entrance, he rapped on the kitchen door for a good 3 minutes to no avail. His father had said the Earl wanted Lady Juliana to come home again and stop playing at her charity work. Neil had thought it would be a simple assignment. He'd be in and out. Apparently, he'd misjudged. So far, nothing about Lady Juliana had been simple. Least of all, his reaction to her. He hadn't expected her to be so damned delicious. Even the smattering of flour and dough on what must at one time have been an expensive dress couldn't take away from the sensuality of her generous curves, the luster of her coppery hair, or the way her mouth turned up in just the barest hint of a smile. He'd wanted to kiss that mouth to see if it was as soft as it looked. From the way she'd looked at him, Neil didn't think she'd object to a kiss either. Such thoughts weren't like him. He might no longer be a soldier, but he still considered Lady Juliana a mission. One did not kiss missions unless one was Ralph Beaumont. And Neil thanked God daily he wasn't Ralph Beaumont. After another knock went unanswered, Neil supposed he would have to make the vendor drag the cart around to the front, but as he turned to give the directive, the kitchen door popped open. No one stood in the doorway, and when Neil leaned closer, he saw the latch was ineffective and the lock useless. Considering the look of the man Neil had encountered in the parlour earlier, he would have thought security a high priority for Lady Juliana. Anyone could walk in and steal from the orphans, or worse, and in Spitalfields, the "or worse" happened more often than not. He'd made a mental list he'd titled Problems and Dangers Relating to St. Dismas Orphanage, and he planned to mention it to Lady Juliana at the first opportunity. Poor security would be at the top, and the primary reason she should return to her father's abode immediately. In the meantime, he gestured to the pie man.
"Bring the pies in here and set them on this table."
"Yes, Gav." The man went to work, while Neil looked in the hallway for any sign of Lady Juliana. She was nowhere to be seen, but the raucous sound of boys' laughter floated down from above, and then there was a thump and a cheer.
"Sounds like you got a full house, Gav."
Neil looked up at the ceiling as the next thump sounded, then he handed the man a pound.
"Come back tomorrow and there will be another just like it."
The man's eyes grew large as he stared at his bounty.
"I'll be here, Gav. You can count on Jacob, you can."
He walked as if in a daze out of the kitchen. Neil shut the kitchen door and studied the broken bolt just as another thump shook the house. This time it was followed by the unmistakable sound of a woman's voice. He'd have to leave the lock for later, so he shoved a heavy crate half full of potatoes in front of the door and made his way through the building. The building was large and, from what he could surmise, had probably once been the home of a well-to-do merchant. It was close to the large market in Spital Square that had operated there since King Charles II had granted its charter, but the building had not been the home of a prosperous merchant in some time. Neil knew little about fashionable furnishings, but everything he saw looked old-fashioned and faded, like a painting left in the sunlight too long. From what he'd seen so far, the kitchen, dining room, and a third room, probably a library or parlour, were on the first floor. He imagined servants' quarters were on the lower level and the drawing room and bedchambers on the second floor. He hadn't looked closely when he'd been outside, but he didn't think the building high enough for a third floor. Likely Lady Juliana had converted public rooms on the second floor into dormitories for the boys. Neil found the stairs inside the small, dark vestibule. He'd seen them when Goring, the manservant, had shown him in. As he stood at the base, more cheers rang out above him, followed by groans. Lady Juliana's voice grew louder. Neil began to climb the rickety staircase, and when he reached the landing, he said a silent prayer that, whatever hell he was about to enter, it wouldn't involve more rats. He turned left, toward the noise, and stepped into a room with rows of four beds on either side. At the far end, a crowd of boys had gathered. Above their heads, he could just see Lady Juliana standing in the center, straining, her arms spread wide.
"Fight! Fight! Fight!" the boys chanted. "There will be no fighting!" the lady said through clenched teeth.
Neil realized she must have been holding two boys apart. He looked around for another adult who might be charged with supervising the children, and saw no one. Was the petite daughter of the Earl of St. Maur the sole authority in an orphanage full of boys? This was even worse than he'd thought. Neil crossed his arms over his chest and cleared his throat just loud enough for the boys in the outer circle to hear him. One or two turned around, and eyes growing large as plates, they tapped the shoulders of their neighbours. Neil watched awareness ripple through the circle, and within seconds the boys parted, leaving the two combatants and Lady Juliana exposed. Those three were so occupied they did not see him. The two boys, about 8 years of age, if he judged correctly, swung at each other and tried to skirt around Lady Juliana. For her part, she ordered them to cease this instant and do behave while she danced between them and kept them apart. He shouldn't have wanted to laugh. He never laughed any more, and this situation was particularly unamusing because he had a feeling that the more trouble Lady Juliana faced with these lads, the more determined she would be to reform them. On the other hand, perhaps after this experience, she would have seen the futility of reform and would welcome being saved. That cheerful thought gave him pause to appreciate how utterly ridiculous, and, truth be told, adorable she looked. She couldn't have been more than an inch or two over 5 feet, and the curves her efforts exposed above the high waist of the voluminous skirt were nicely rounded. Her coppery red hair fell about her shoulders, and her large brown eyes flashed anger, while the pale skin that often accompanied that red shade of hair was tinged pink with exertion. With all the flour and dirt streaking her cheeks and arms, her wrinkled gown and her hair flying in every direction, she should have looked as though she ought to be a resident of the orphanage. Instead, she brought to mind the image of a woman rising from rumpled sheets, skin pink from exertion and pleasure. He had heard his half-brothers mention her name a time or two over the years. Lady Juliana was considered a beauty and had a dowry large enough to tempt one or two of them to court her, though it appeared no one had tempted her into marriage. Either that or her suitors had run screaming from the room at one flash of fire from her eyes. She did have expressive eyes, but he wasn't cowed, and unfortunately, neither were her charges. Neil straightened his shoulders and marched forward to do what he'd come to do, save the day. Standing before the threesome, he cleared his throat again. This time the three pairs of eyes darted to his face. Lady Juliana's gaze locked on his in horror, but the two boys were too enraged to take much note of him. Instead, they took advantage of the lady's momentary lapse of attention and tore at each other like rabid dogs. With a screech, the lady jumped back and out of the way. And then, instead of doing what she ought and scampering to safety, she jumped between the two boys. Neil was so completely surprised that he didn't move for a full 3 seconds. In that time, she almost parted the boys, but her skirts tangled about her feet and she ended up on her bottom.
"What the devil is going on?" Neil bellowed. "You, over there! You on that side!"
His temper began to simmer, and he pushed it back down, reminding himself these were children. He reminded himself as well that he'd sworn after that bloody day in Portugal he would never lose control again. Like a fist closing, he reined his emotions in and stepped forward. The two combatants scattered, and Neil held out a hand to Lady Juliana. She brushed it away. Confused, Neil continued to extend it, but she didn't take it. Instead, he stared in astonishment as she climbed to her feet, unassisted. Then she pushed her hair out of her eyes and glared at him. She'd probably been glaring at him for several moments, but he hadn't been able to see for the profusion of coppery hair.
You!
The one word was full of seething anger and condemnation. What the devil was wrong with the woman? Perhaps she'd misunderstood.
I would have helped you to your feet, my lady, he said.
Oh, I think you've helped quite enough for one day, she answered, her jaw clenched and her lips barely moving. He stared at her and pointed a finger at his chest as if to ask whether she was referring to him. She gestured to the pugilists.
I have the situation under control.
He let out a huff of laughter. She was obviously deluded.
Is that what you call it?
She looked as though she had a ready retort on her lips, but he was saved from the tongue-lashing when one of the boys who had been fighting jumped forward.
Forgive me, my lady, I didn't mean to make you fall.
Me either,
the other one said, head hanging in a very good imitation of one shamed by his actions. She gave the boys narrowed looks.
This wouldn't have happened if you had not been fighting. How many times have I told you fighting is not allowed?
One of the boys with dark hair and freckles waved his hand and jumped up and down eagerly.
Oh, I know, I know.
She turned and sighed.
Michael? 112 times, Lady Juliana. I've been counting, I have.
I know you have, Michael. Your counting skills are quite extraordinary. She looked back at the combatants.
You would think, after a glance at Michael, 112 reminders, you would know the rule by now.
I do, Lady Juliana, but he took my cards.
This from what Neil had come to consider the older combatant, as he was taller and had a shaggy mane of brown hair. The other, a bit shorter, with curly blonde hair and a chubby face, which grew redder at the accusation, clenched his fists.
Did not. Those cards are mine.
Are not.
Are too,
countered the younger one. Neil raised his brows at Lady Juliana, as if to ask whether this was what she meant by under control. She glared right back at him, then held her hand out in front of the boy with the curly hair.
Give me the cards, George.
But, Lady Juliana,
George whined, I told you there's to be no gambling.
No fighting, no gambling. What type of establishment is this?
Neil drawled. She turned her fiery brown eyes on him.
And you, sir, I will speak with you in the parlour, if you would kindly wait for me there.
He gave her a mock bow.
Of course, my lady.
But she would not win the field that easily.
The pies in the kitchen are growing cold.
Pies!
That exclamation from every child in the room. And then he flinched as a line of boys, every bit as formidable as one of the French battalions, raced past him, thundered down the steps, and presumably landed in the kitchen. The lady blew out an exasperated breath as though to indicate he had done something else of which she disapproved.
I'd better go down and make sure the little ones are given their fair share. There will be no practicing table manners this morning, she said, attempting to sweep by him as though her stained attire were a court presentation dress.
He caught her arm, surprised by the warmth of her skin.
A moment of your time, my lady. I believe introductions are in order.
She sighed.
You are right. I've been terribly remiss. The morning has been rather hectic. I wish I could say it has been unusually hectic, but I'm afraid chaos has been the norm since I arrived.
He released her arm.
And when did you arrive?
Oh, almost 3 months ago. Or has it been four?
The shock must have showed on his face, because she quickly continued, It used to be much, much worse. we actually have something of a routine now. This was a routine. A crash sounded from somewhere in the building, but before she could run off, he made a slight bow.
I am Neil Raxel. My father is the Marquis of Kensington.
Her eyes narrowed. Then you've come at my father's request. St. Maur and Kensington have been friends since their days at school. He inclined his head.
As you say.
And you obviously know I am Lady Juliana. He would have made some nonsense remark about how he was pleased to meet her, although he hadn't been particularly pleased yet, but she held up a hand to stay his response. I see what this is about, and I regret to inform you that you are wasting your time. I have no intention of returning home until I have matters here in order. My father wants me to dance at balls and attend the theatre.
I ask you, how am I to attend the theatre with all of this to think of?
Neil knew an ambush when he saw one, and he remained silent.
If my father sent you to convince me to return home, you are wasting your time, sir.
I am not here to convince you to leave, he said.
In fact, he'd intended to simply carry her out, put her in a coach, and send her home. He saw now that while brute tactics might win the battle, they wouldn't win the war. She'd be right back here. And then so would he. This moment called for diplomacy, as Rafe would have called it. Ewan would have called Neil's next words by their true nature a lie.
I am here because your father is worried for your safety. He asked me to put measures in place to ensure you are well protected.
She gave him a wary look. My father said that. I didn't actually speak to the Earl, but that is my interpretation. A very loose interpretation.
What sorts of measures? She asked with narrowed eyes.
I don't know yet. I'll need to do some reconnaissance before I make recommendations.
Reconnaissance? Are you by any chance a soldier, Mr. Axel?
I was. Now would come the endless questions about what branch he served in and the battles he fought in, and when she learned he was one of Draven's dozen, she would probably press a hand to her chest and flutter her lashes. He wouldn't mind that reaction, though he certainly would be no gentleman if he took advantage of her swoon to kiss her. She turned her back on him and walked away. Neil frowned. Where was the swoon and his ill-gotten kiss?
Go ahead and do your reconnaissance, sir. You may note your recommendations when you are finished. I trust that will be shortly.
She paused at the door and looked over her shoulder at him. We have no need for soldiers and military regimentation here. Her skirts swished as she moved into the corridor and down the stairs. Neil could have imagined how lush her hips looked as she moved. He gritted his teeth and shifted his thoughts back to the mission. Clasping his hands behind his back, he surveyed the dormitory. A handful of buckets littered the floor, half full of water from the rains the night before. He looked up at the leaky ceiling and noted the plaster was crumbling in more places than he could count. None of the boys' beds were made. Blankets and pillows were thrown on the floor, as were articles of clothing. Dirty clothing, pamphlets, half-eaten apples, and decks of cards and dice littered the trunks at the end of the beds. No wonder the place had rats. He quickly found the box that housed the creatures near the window on the far side of the room. Even from this distance, he could see the latch on the window was broken. No doubt the boys were sneaking out at night and doing God knew what. He had his work cut out for him, and this was but one room in what he estimated to be close to a dozen. One thing was for certain. Lady Juliana might not know it, but she needed military regimentation, and a whole hell of a lot of it. Julia fumed all the way to the kitchen, and then she fumed more when she saw the state in which the boys had left it. She'd have to spend half the morning putting everything to rights. If her father wanted to help her, why didn't he send her a maid or a cook? She could sorely use one of each. Leave it to a man to send help in the form of one more inconvenience. On the other hand, if her father knew her lady's maid had resigned and the cook had fled and she was living here 3 or 4 days a week, essentially unchaperoned, he would have come himself and dragged her home. At least the boys would be busy for the next few hours. Mrs. Fleming should have arrived by now. The teacher would have had to begin her lessons late, but some education was better than the complete ignorance in which the boys had been living before she arrived. Julia found the broom and sighed over the crumbs and smashed bits